Okay, the thing reads, I saw the title here, which is a good thing if you're going to do this, and it says, but the Bible says so. How do I respond to someone who doesn't believe the Bible is true? Well, what I'm going to give you is like 10 quick answers, and it all depends on the context, because I want to say, like, okay, who is saying this, and for what reason are they saying this? But it's just going to be like potato chips. I'm going to track through 10 things. When did they tell you we're supposed to be done? I'm getting all these different answers, and it's like 11. Does that make sense? And then you've got another thing. Okay, all right, well, good. See, ask the people in charge. They don't know, but you guys are absolutely clued in here. All right, this actually happens quite a bit. I mean, when I work with students, most of the people in our church are students from Northwestern, or in some cases Loyola and DePaul, and some from Moody and Trinity, but a lot of them are from Northwestern University, which is not a Christian school. It started that way. The seal at Northwestern University, you know where Northwestern is? I mean, you know what I'm talking about? Like, it's the private school in the Big Ten. On the seal, it says in Greek, the word full of grace and truth, because it was a Methodist school. And so many of these schools, like Harvard and, you know, Northwestern and Vanderbilt, where I went and so forth, used to be Christian schools, but they traded away their heritage and became secular schools. But there's John 1:14 in Greek up there. But it's not so Christian anymore. It's not warmly evangelical. Now, there are Christian groups on campus like the RUF and the FCA and the IVCF and the Campus Crusade and Baptist Collegiate Ministry and so forth. But very, very heterodox. In the Student Center, they have an office for the gay, lesbian, transgendered, bi folks. But we've just had to recertify. All the religious groups had to recertify to have our standing on campus. And I get the impression they would not weep a tear if the BCM went off campus or went under, but if the GLBTS, or what did I hear? The Gilberts, I heard it called the other day, gay, lesbian, something, something, transgendered. I think they're more precious. So we're kind of in a curious setting. We also have a lot of people from overseas. We have folks who don't know the Bible at all. A lot of Asians who are either non-believers at all. I mean, perhaps communist. Communism's pretty much played out in China, but a lot of Muslims and so forth. And some people just don't even know the Bible. Or if you came back, now I grew up in Arkansas, but if you could come back with a proof text, well, it says here, like, whoa, okay, sorry. But you do this in that setting, and they're like, well, fine, play with it in the street. You know, what's that all about? So part of it is just dealing with people who know nothing about the Bible. The first thing I would say is, you know, I don't believe the Bible. I said, well, have you read it? I mean, the Bible is extraordinarily self-attesting. It's not just sort of like picking up a Wheaties box and reading the back, or reading Shakespeare, for that matter. You know, you're grinding through assignments all the time. But there's something weird when you read that Bible. It sort of has a way to grab you. And you know, I was thinking Adam was naming the animals in Genesis 2. You know, and God said, all right, name the animals. All right, there you are, rhino, you know, squirrel, ferret, you know, going through. And then a woman walks up, and he says, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Like, essentially, now you're talking. And there is something about the Bible that will let you, you know, you read a bunch of stuff, and you read it, and you think, wow, this is powerful stuff. So one of the most dangerous things you can do is actually put a Bible in someone's hand and just say, read it. And by the way, the knowledge of the Word of God is just drying up in the land. When I was at Vandy, I was working for the National Endowment for the Humanities, and there's a fellow named John Silber who's president of Boston University, and he came to town, and I was his chauffeur for a few days as he spoke on campus and in TV stations and stuff like that. And he said that when he first went to the University of Texas as a philosophy teacher, one of the things he did was to give a Bible knowledge test to the Longhorns or whatever they were, freshmen coming in. And even though he wasn't a Christian himself, he was just taking a reading on how much cultural understanding they had. And he had other little quizzes. And he said when he first went to Texas, I think it was back in the early 50s or something like that, or the mid-50s, he got scores like 85 out of 100 from just Texas kids walking in, you know. And when he left in the early 70s, I think it was like 38 was the average. that there's just this drying up of the knowledge of the Word of God in the land. And it used to be the case you could just refer to something in the Bible and people, you know, all right, boring, I've heard that. And now it's like, whoa, what's that? Slow down. We were on a mission trip from First Baptist Franklin, Tennessee, to Fishers, Indiana. And we were doing backyard Bible clubs and the thing where you put the big parachute out and all the kids, you know, and you do that up and they run underneath and like this. And so we were going through the neighborhood the day before we did it, and we said, okay, now guys, if you'll go to this yard down here tomorrow, we're going to get together and tell stories about Jesus. And this little girl rode up on her bike. She was about 8. She says, "Who's Jesus?" And we thought, oh, you're funny, you know. No, she wasn't kidding. She did not know. She had never heard who Jesus was at all. And I thought, well, you're a prime candidate to come to Bible school. But there's a poverty of the knowledge of Jesus. Now, there's a guy named George Mavrotis who taught at the University of Michigan for years. And, you know, he was arguing in a book called Belief in God about how you can meet God or how you can know that he's true or the Bible's true. And he had a really interesting answer. It used to be the case that I've been in more or less professional philosophy for, you know, since 1974, since when I got my degree. And it used to be the case that you would make an argument for God's existence and then someone will say, well, I don't see that, or, you know, I don't. And it used to be like, oh, okay, I've got to try again. I've got to come up with another argument because you're so discriminating. But it's subtly changed now, where you sort of say, oh, I'm sorry, you have a personal problem. Well, let me see if I can help you. You know, like, wait, you can't do that. Well, I just did. You want to see it again? But it's sort of like, here's what Mavrotis does. Someone says, well, I've never experienced God. I've never experienced the truth of the Bible. And you're like, okay, and your point would be what? And he says, well, I have, but you haven't. All right, let me tell you. And here's an example he uses. He says, imagine you're in North Carolina and it's like the fall and it's sundown and twilight time, and you come to a clearing in the woods and you look to the west toward the sunset and a panther comes out of the forest and walks across the clearing. And it's like, wow. And you're standing on this particular stump and you're looking in that direction. And you come back and you tell folks, man, I saw a panther out there, big old panther out in the woods, maybe under the cut where the power lines are. And people say, a guy goes out and says, well, I didn't see a panther. And he said, and right, but that doesn't mean I didn't see a panther. Well, how could I see a panther? Well, I don't know. I can't guarantee it. Panthers have wills. You know, they can go where they want to go. But what you might do is go like October 15th about sundown and stand on this stump and look west, and you might see a panther. I did. His point is, look, if you haven't experienced God, what you might do is like open the Bible to the book of John, for example, or Mark, and God might show up. He did in my life, you know, just give it a shot. You might see a panther. And so getting them into the Word of God sometimes is kind of the most dynamically treacherous thing you can do to them. Like, oh, you don't believe in the Bible? Why don't you read it, you know? So don't underestimate the power of the Word of God. Now, that doesn't necessarily solve the issue right there, but it gets them on track. I mean, you know, every once in a while you'll see a guy who reviews a book and then you find out he didn't read it. You know, like he'll say, oh, this is a terrible book and I think blah, 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 like that. And then you'll have the answer from the author of the next issue of the magazine. And they say, well, if John had read my book, he'd know that the third chapter deals with that very thing he brought up. Well, a lot of people are critical of the Bible and they've not read it. They don't know it, so just challenge them that. Now, here's another setting. Second thing, the Bible is not alone in its attestations. If you're trying to persuade someone of an ethical thing, you don't even have to use the Bible. Let me tie you into something called natural law theory. You may be familiar with this, but there's a guy named Thomas Aquinas. He's not the only one, but Thomas Aquinas was a Catholic theologian, and he said, look, we don't know the mind of God. We'll call that the eternal law, like God's plan or his thought. But, you know, he's graciously revealed his will to us. I mean, I don't know what's in your mind. You may be thinking, this is the most wonderful thing that's ever happened in my life. I'm drinking out of a fire hose of wisdom. Or you may be thinking, boy, he's old and fat. How long am I going to have to sit here? You know, I don't know what you're thinking. But that's the same with God. We don't read his mind. But he reveals himself to us. And he does it two ways. One way is through Scripture. And that's called divine law. And if you want to know what God thinks, then read Genesis or 1 Timothy. But he also reveals himself in nature. And that's natural law or in creation. You can just kind of figure things out. Look, even lost people can realize that men are from Mars and women from Venus or something like that. You know, there do seem to be differences out there. And things that work and don't work. And on the basis of divine law, then you draft what some call canon law or ecclesiastical law, the church law. For example, he says in Romans 1, homosexuality is not okay. Application, don't have homosexual pastors, okay? Something like that, or priests. Natural law is the basis of human law. That is to say, we can agree with atheists, Orthodox Jews, Zoroastrians, Rosicrucians, Methodists, and Catholics that incest is wrong. If you want to see a book kind of about that, there's a little bitty book by C.S. Lewis called The Abolition of Man. And in the back, he talks about the Tao, or spelled T-A-O. And he traces through history, from like Hammurabi's code, through Norse legends, through whatever, Deepak Chopra or somebody, there are trends, like take care of your parents, you know, be faithful in marriage. And people who don't know the Bible, they've picked up on it. It's kind of sensible. Well, this, we don't access God. This is the area, kind of a biblical, I guess you could say sort of biblical theology. And then this is sort of the area of philosophy. And you got the theta and the phi there. And this is called special revelation. And this is called general revelation. And general revelation is kind of the heavens declare the glory of God. Or Romans 2, or Romans 1 says, they have their gender or sexual orientation, but they deny it and give it up. And like men have sex with men and women with women, therefore they get the condemnation in themselves. They're just saying, look, the world is just built a certain way. And it's just, you can like do strange stuff with it, but it doesn't overturn the nature of the world. Actually, Romans 2, 14 and 15 says, the Gentile who does not have the Torah or the law has the law written on his heart, and his conscience accuses him or excuses him. So, you know, you might be in some primitive society up in the valleys of the Himalayas or something like that, and some guy says, all right, everybody, we're going to go out and hunt some neighbor and some guy from the other valley and, like, kill him and eat him. And this guy who's never heard the Bible says, man, I don't know. That kind of seems a little wrong, you know. And he says, well, his conscience accuses him. Or someone might say in the tribe, look, everybody's doing this. If you're not doing it, you're really out of whack. And he says, no, I really think it's okay not to do that. His conscience excuses him. And that stuff is available across cultures. Now you're thinking, oh, so you're kind of finding out what people, most people do. No, it's really what people do who flourish. For example, if you take acorns, how many acorns that fall, and by the way, I had a student at Wheaton once correct me and said it's acorn, but I think it's acorn. At any rate, I hope I don't offend you by my pronunciation. If 10,000 acorns drop on campus, or I think we have beaches. I don't know if we have oak trees. But anyway, let's just say this part of town. How many of them become oaks, do you think? Just, I mean, who could guess? But, you know, at most 1%, probably a tiny, tiny fraction, because the squirrels eat them, or they rot, or they roll in the road and somebody drives over them. So if you statistically say what the natural thing is for the acorn, then you would say the natural thing for an acorn is to, like, die and amount to nothing. Or feed a squirrel. But there's another sense of the natural thing of an acorn, and it's like when an acorn does the acorn thing, it becomes an oak tree. And that's the sense of natural law. What is it that causes human flourishing? You know, Yeah, you can do that. You know, yes, you can get no sleep, you know, drink to excess, and pick fights for fun, and you will be dead soon, you know. It's kind of like this. Let's take the Ten Commandments, and we'll draw the line right here. All of you, for the next year, systematically disobey the Ten Commandments the best you can. You guys obey the Ten Commandments, and we'll come back in a year and see how it went. Well, you guys won't even be back. You'll be in jail or dead, you know, because you murdered somebody and robbed something and were adulterous and so forth. The point is this. You don't so much break the Ten Commandments as you break yourself on the Ten Commandments. You see, they're not just arbitrary. God's not up there like, let's make up a funny rule and see if they're serious. You know, so he kind of puts this limbo bar down, and you know, you're kind of contorting and the angels are laughing, you know. This is like the way to like living well. Look, I was talking to this guy. I work on a website based in New York, and we're talking to this guy from the Hudson Institute named Herb London. And he said, let me tell you about poverty, one thing about poverty. I think I've got this right. He says, if you do five things, you have a 99% chance of not being in poverty. All right? Now you're thinking, yeah, go to med school, you know, like travel Europe and take notes and then write something. No. It's like finish high school, don't get pregnant out of wedlock. The men are saying, got that one, you know, but, right? Don't get pregnant without being married. Don't do drugs. Don't become heavily entwined in alcohol and hold a job for a year. You know, this isn't like rocket science, but if you can just do those simple things, and yet a lot of people don't do it, you know, and then they get in trouble and their lives are strained and, you know, God's redemptive, he can do things, but it's like there really are ways to like live and not live. Now, to bring it around about, let's say, well, I was at hearings once in Gary, Indiana. They got casinos now when you get on the Skyway and you go through there. And I was back when they were having hearings. Should we bring casino gambling into Gary to revitalize Gary and so forth? So we had a guy from the Christian Life Commission come up, Larry Braidfoot, to testify. And all the slick guys from Atlantic City and from Vegas came in with massive portfolios and big charts and glossies, and they wore Armani suits, and here comes Larry. He's kind of like Opie from the Southern Baptist Convention and polyester, and he didn't get up there and quote the Bible. I mean, he didn't just sort of like, and the Bible said, I mean, first, there's no verse that says, you know, he who gambles or plays keno is an abomination in the nostrils of the Lord. That's not up there. But you can talk in terms of stewardship of one's life and, you know, love of neighbor, because the only way you win at gambling is that your neighbor's disadvantage. I mean, they have to lose. More people have to lose for you to win, and so forth. And so anyway, but he didn't get up there because he knew those people didn't believe the Bible or didn't care about it. The Vegas guys and probably half of the city council didn't. So he talked about what had happened to Atlantic City, how actually there was no movie theater in Atlantic City anymore, and there were many more pawn shops, and there were fewer grocery stores. And you think, well, wait, no. They bring the casino in, and it's a city unto itself, and the rest of the community dries up. Prostitution increases. They bust the drivers in from other parts of Jersey and from New York, and the next thing you know, that Atlantic City is more squalid than it was. And he's basically saying, life, the world, will prove the folly of it. I mean, you can do the same sort of thing in a lot of ways. So you say, look, I can... See, God created the world. All truth is God's truth. He made people the way they are. So we don't even have to quote Bible verses. We'll just say, fine, we'll talk about the natural order of things. Thomas Aquinas would do this. He would say, all right, look, sex. We talk about homosexuality. Romans 1 says it's wrong in different, you know, whatever, different passages. But he says, look, what is sex? Let's just talk among us girls here, all right? Sex is procreative. It makes babies, and it is unitive. That is to say, it's a way that people get together for fellowship or something like that. All right? Now, he says, this isn't rocket science. Can you imagine someone who didn't know one or the other of these? That, you know, it's just like prom night and someone's sort of out in a car and having sex and having just a wonderful time, they think. And then a baby happens. It's like, duh, you know. There are actually people like that, but they're not, you know, the sharpest knife in the drawer. And then you have people, let's say people who don't know it's Unitive. They just think it makes babies. So the minister says, look, we don't have enough kids in the nursery here. We need some volunteers, you know. All right, Martha and I will do what we can. You know, you volunteer. And in the midst of this baby making, they think, wow, we should do this again sometime, you know. It's like, all right, genius. Now, he argues, the Catholics argue, that if you take sex, no scripture verses yet, just like people who are vaguely aware of reality know this is sex. He says you take sex out of the procreative context and it's unnatural sex. Hence, homosexuality is unnatural sex. Well, it's like, well, yeah, but I really feel attracted that way and I just feel loved and affirmed and it's just who I am. Okay. You have those tendencies, and you like to do it. So that's what you mean by natural? Oh, I see. So I'll glorify all my tendencies. Let's see. I like to, like, close my eyes and drive, like, 90 sometimes when I don't see a lot of people in the interstate. You know, for only, like, 5 or 6 seconds, but I really get a buzz out of that. And I went to a store once, and I didn't have all the money I wanted, but I saw things I wanted there, and no one was around, and so I took it, and I didn't pay. And now I have it. And I still have all my money. What's not to like? Oh, that's great. I'll go back and do that. Like, come on. Well, I was born that way. I was born in my tendencies. I have to affirm it. No. Just because you have a tendency doesn't mean you have to act upon it. And so you come back and say, the point is not that you want to do that. I mean, I think in church settings sometimes at a business meeting, you want to like hit somebody. But just because you want to do it doesn't mean it's appropriate. So you say, so you don't, you're not driven by your wants or your feelings, but you're motivated by what seems to cause human flourishing. So I'm saying there are two tracks you can go. If someone is not persuaded that they should not be promiscuous or larcenous or what have you, you could say, all right, you don't believe the Bible, then we'll just read the Bible of creation because God made it anyway. So let's talk about, you know. By the way, I found a really interesting article in a magazine called The Economist. It's like a British Time magazine / Forbes / whatever, National Review, New Republic. And they said there's a real problem with incest in India. And the reason is they're aborting their girls. I mean, girls are expensive. You have to have a dowry. And you raise them, you invest in them, and then you give them away, and then they don't produce for you, and you had to pay a lot of money. So they think, we need to have boys. So it's illegal now, but they still do it. They roll these ultrasound machines around from village to village, and they take a reading, and they find out if it's a boy or a girl. And if it's a girl, quite often they'll abort the child. Now, the problem is they've aborted so many girls in India. They've done it in China, too, because you have a one-child policy, and they figure if I want one, it's going to be a boy. And so in India, it's like instead of 50-50 boy-girl, it's more like 55-45 or 60-40 heavy on the guys. And the guys have to, it's like a Foxworthy joke, they have to go to family reunions to get dates, you know? And so it's all out of whack. But then they say, except in the state of Kerala, where there's no problem. Why is that? It's the Christian one. Was it Thomas or who was it? St. Thomas was supposed to have traveled east and founded the church there. And they just say in passing, this isn't like Focus on the Family. This is the British Economist. And they're saying where the Christians are, somehow they don't kill their baby girls. And so you don't have problems with incest and relatives. It's like no Bible verse there. It's just like, hello, Berlin, come in. The life of the Bible is the life of life. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, you could work that. Third, let's say you're talking to a Muslim. The first was like, have them read the Bible. That's the first thing. Second, you could use natural law to make your same argument because God wrote creation as well as he wrote the Bible. Okay. The third, I would say use the critical apparatus. Now, that's something you may not be talking about, but they teach you that at seminary. You read a Greek New Testament, and at the bottom of the New Testament is where that particular manuscript came from. that particular passage came from. And you have, you don't have the actual paper or papyrus that John wrote on at, in Patmos, all right? Or, you know, you've got ink that was held, I mean, whether, you know, Paul wrote it himself or had a secretary and he dictated, but you don't have that actual piece of paper where Paul was standing in the room. I think it's merciful that God didn't let it continue to exist, because we would worship it and have pilgrimages and shrines and people try to touch it and get healed and get crazy, you know. But we do have all these different attestations, early manuscripts. And so if there's a slight variation in a text, then what they'll do is they'll say, this is one way it, and it shows up in Papyrus 46 and the Codex Vaticanus and the Codex Sinaiticus. This one comes from a third century lectionary, or, you know, the, a reference in Ambrosiaster's writings or whatever. And it show, and it's just thick with all this serious, serious biblical scholarship trying to get what they call the original autograph, the original writing, what it said. And by the way, important things aren't disputed there. It's just, it's a little bitty stuff. But there is no text in the history of the world that is more painstakingly verified as your Bible. And as you read your Greek, you'll see all that went into it. Now, the Muslims, if you're talking to like a Muslim, there are like, I don't know, a billion of them on earth, so you might be talking to one. They like to say, oh, we're people of the book too. We have the Quran, you know, Quran, I try to say it Arabic sometimes, but the Quran. And then you have like the Jewish Old Testament, and then you've got the New Testament. And the New Testament is called the Injil. Oh, we have great respect for the Injil. Oh, wonderful, excellent. Let's open the Injil. Let's open the Gospels. Well, it's been corrupted. It's been polluted. I picked this up at Urbana once. They were talking about witnessing to Muslims. And instead of like, oh my goodness, they say, oh no, really? Wow, that's a shocker. So the New Testament's corrupted. Well, could you show me where? You know, well, they don't have a clue. They just heard that one line, jada boom sort of thing from somebody. And you mess with them in a way. Like, oh, please, here, would you show me that where it was corrupted? They can't answer that. And then you start to explain how we got our New Testament and all the painstaking care that went into it to verify the text that we use. And, well, they don't have a clue, but it's a way of pulling the rug out from under it. I mean, it's like when you, I remember when I lived in Indianapolis, we would go visiting, oh, I don't know, where it was like Brownsburg or something up in the Northwest, and we go door to door knocking on doors. And, hi, we're from such and such Baptist church. And they'd say, oh, we're from St. Athanasius, you know. We're down in St. Procopius, you know, stuff like that. Oh, yeah, that's the one up here. Who's the priest there now? They don't know. I mean, they just, that's their little one-liner, like their zinger, like, oh, no, we're Catholic, don't touch me. I think they were told to say that or something. But mess with them a little bit. Like, oh, yeah. I do it in Evanston. We have a St. Athanasius church. We have several there. But St. Athanasius was like a hero in Christology, and at the Council of Nicaea led the attack against the Arians and the people who denied the divinity of Christ. And he's really, we love St. Athanasius. And I say, oh, wow, I love St. Athanasius. He's such and such and such and such. And they don't know who St. Athanasius is, if they know who the priest is, at any rate. Or I'll knock on a Jewish door, you know. A lot of Jews in Evanston. And we're from such and such temple, Bethel or Beth Emmet or whatever. And it turns out my daughter's named Chesed, which means loving kindness. I don't know like that, but it's Chesed. And I say, oh, I love Hebrew. You know, in seminary we would study that, like Genesis 1:1, better sheep bara Elohim et HaShemayim ve'et HaAretz. And they don't know Hebrew. You know, we'll go to the bar mitzvahs or bat mitzvahs, and the little kid's up there, and he's got the Torah open, and they're going through, and it's printed, and we're just following along, you know, with the Hebrew. And all the Jews are looking like, what's the goy doing here, you know? But, you know, you could just sort of say, wow, do you realize how precious the Bible is? And, you know, and kind of call their bluff, in a sense. And I don't mean in a mean way, but help them realize This is actually quite an extraordinarily and excruciatingly produced book. And people will, like, believe things about Socrates or, some ancient figure, and there's just two or three writings, and you're like, you buy this about Alexander the Great, but you don't buy this? I mean, this is an ancient document, which has great scare. Okay, number four. I have down here, use Gleason Archer. He's just one of a scad of people who can defend the integrity of the Bible. You know, they may say, well, it's got contradictions, you know, or it's legends, or the Gilgamesh epic is really just the Noah story, you know, stripped of all its ornamentation, or there are contradictions in the Bible. And you kind of go, oh, really? What is one? What might be one of those? And you realize there are books and books of like addressing tough biblical sayings or Bible difficulties, and they're online and they're just all over the place. And it's just amazing how many answers are so simple. I mean, a lot of times something is not a contradiction at all. I mean, it might say something like, I don't know, he was in the room and Mary and Martha were there. And then in another section it says Mary was there. Ah, see, it's a contradiction. That's not a contradiction. If Mary and Martha were there, Mary was there. I mean, you know, they just tell the story slightly differently. Or in Britain, I think one guy was saying, oh, yeah, the Bible condemns homosexuality. Well, it also condemns the eating of shrimp, shellfish. So you gay bashers are out there at, you know, Jolly Roger or something having shrimp. Come on, what's this about? And then you get to talk to them about progressive revelation. That, I mean, look, there are thousands and thousands of answers to these little things, but progressive revelation says that the earliest part is not the full revelation, but that was theocratic and this and that, and some was hygienic and some was ceremonial. And you show, look, let's just say my daughter, Kessid, she went to Pepperdine. She was in Chicago, and she said, okay, she got the little diagram out and said, okay, how can I be the farthest from my parents by a beach where it's warm? And she found Malibu, you know, like the slums of Malibu. She went to college. And so she's out at Pepperdine. And let's say when she was three, we said, now, Kessa, don't cross the street without mom and daddy holding your hand. Right, don't do that. You know, slap it like that. Now, stop. Okay, so she waits and we cross the street. So now we go to Parents' Day at Pepperdine. And we see her up on the hill above the Pacific Highway, and we driving in, old embarrassing parents, you know, and say, hey, Kessa, come on, we'll go out and eat. She runs down the hill a little bit and then stops, right? And we think, come on, you know, we're going to beat the Methodists there or something, you know. And we finally have to walk up there and say, what's the deal? And she says, well, I didn't want to cross the street. You told me not to unless... We never repealed that, did we? No, listen, that was good when you were a kid, but now you really can't cross the street yourself, okay? Well, there are things in the Bible that were sort of like, don't cross the street until I hold your hand. But as the fuller revelation comes, you don't have quite the same thing. There is continuity on some things and not on others. You know, in some cases, he affirms and deepens the Old Testament. You have heard that you should not murder. I'm telling you, you shouldn't hate. Keep the murder as a prohibition. Now add the hate thing. So show them just Bible interpretation rules a little bit, a little hermeneutics, all right? Anyway, there are lots of books about that. Number five, I say use Josh McDowell. Now, he's just one guy, but I use him as a representative. Josh McDowell wrote a couple of books back in the 70s called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And it's really about the Bible and what an incredible, incredible book it is. Look how the prophecies link up. Look how, with all these different authors spread over thousands of years, it all coordinates into this beautiful unity. Look at this, look at that. They said this wouldn't be true. Now we've found the archaeological ruins to show there really was such a guy or something like that. So they're wonderful books that just attest to the splendor of the Bible. So you don't believe the Bible? Hey, guess what, you know? How about that, you know? Or what's that? Who, Dad? Yeah. No, how about that? Okay. Number six. There is a kind of cultural apologetic. We do some of that here. Let's do a quick version. I know we're short of time here, but let's just play a game here very quickly. Let's like have the world, okay? This is kind of like Hudson Bay. Greenland, somewhere Ireland, England. Somewhere here, Korea, Japan, Australia. All right. Now, and no offense to Italy and Greece. Now, real quick, where are the cars? All right. Just tell me, like, famous cars that have been marketed worldwide. We'll just do, okay, let's do Japan real quick. Just name one or two. Okay, Honda and Toyota. I mean, there are going to be more, but play along. Korean car? Kia. Hyundai. Yeah, Hyundai. Daewoo used to be one, too. Russian car. They used to have some in communist days, and they made them in Czechoslovakia, too. It's like Skoda and Lada, but as soon as the Iron Curtain fell, they threw them in dumpsters. I mean, the closest we had to a communist car was the Yugo from Yugoslavia, and it was a joke. But at any rate, okay. Spanish car. French car. Somebody. Peugeot. How about a Citroën? All right, let's go to Scandinavia. Volvo and Saab. Saab is one, right? German car. Huh? VW, Porsche. Yeah, Porsche, BMW. How about Mercedes-Benz? That'd be a good one. Italian car. Maserati, Ferrari, Lamborghini. You guys have expensive taste. Fiat, that's not so expensive. All right, Greek car. No. Romanian car. American car. All right, Ford, GM, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Chrysler. You never know from week to week anymore. All right, how about an African car? How about a South American car? Now, they make them. They make Volkswagen buses down here, but it's not the home of origin. Now, the question is, why is it that they're... Oh, in England, we got, I guess we got the Rolls and the Bentley, and actually the Morris, I think, the Mini is originally there. Huh? Somebody else had a... Okay, look, this is actually a lecture that takes an hour, but just track with me. Why are there cars some places and not other places? And why are they the developed countries? Huh? Climate? Race? These are all answers people have given. These are why the white folks are. Wrong. Why is there the money there? Why are they living on $2 a day in Haiti and $100 a day in Dominican Republic? I mean, why is it that some cultures flourish and some cultures are in the tank? Huh? You know, it's a good answer. Some people say they have the iron, they have the temperate zone or the rivers and stuff, but they're some of the most resource lush people places on earth are in squalor. I mean, Nigeria is awash in oil right now, and they are just, it's horrible in Nigeria. What? All right, but how does education, how come? Right, and the answer I would suggest, this is cutting to the chase, is that where Christianity has touched, Francis Schaeffer makes this argument as well, that it has a transformative, look, has it ever occurred to you, speaking of cars, there's no Muslim car. I mean, honestly, you know, the entire manufactured output of the Muslim world from like Mauritania to Bangladesh, and I think you can throw in perhaps in Indonesia, is less than that of Finland. It's the reverse Midas touch. Where Islam touches, it turns it to squalor. You think, well, you can't say that. I just did. And, I mean, I could take longer to do it. They can blow up cars. They just can't build them. I mean, not kidding you. It's true. Look, the most important thing about a culture is its religious orientation. I mean, it has a lot to do with, like, free exchange of ideas. If you've got fatwas and imams shutting people down. If the women are all in burqas. I'm telling you, you can kill education, research and development. There's no Muslim car. There's no animist car. Sub-Saharan Africa, the Inuit up here. There's no Sioux or Cheyenne car. because you can't get, you can't build a Boeing 777 out of like sun worship. Or trust me, there's no, the Chinese are kind of coming up with this little car now, but it's not world trade. The only two Asian countries are those which are heavily influenced by Christianity, massive movement of God in Korea. And then we just basically went in and said, the emperor's not the sun king, you know, or whatever. And here's your constitution and behave yourself. And then Tom Cruise, I know he had to die to defend the last shogun or whatever he was. Anyway, but we have heavy. You go to a pure Buddhist country like Myanmar or something, ain't going to have a car. The point is, and you can do this again and again and again with like birth rate, you know, longevity, literacy, incidence of hookworm, you name it, where the Bible people move in. Culture flourishes. Now, but it's fascinating, by the way, how different cultures within Christianity have different cars, too. Michael Novak, a Catholic theologian, argued that a Catholic car is more celebrational. It's kind of like a Maserati or something. Go to Italy to see a Catholic car, and they like to drive fast and paint them red and have the top down. If you want to see a Lutheran car, you know, go to Scandinavia. They're boxy, and they have strong side girders, and they don't rust. And you just drive along grimly and safely. Novak also says, he was on campus a while back, and he says, it's kind of like football. Big Ten football is Lutheran football. You have like large corn-fed Lutherans with heavy calves grunting and moving slowly up and down the field. And he says, Southeastern Conference football is Southern Baptist football. It's just like people having fun slinging passes, doing wild things. And anyway. And by the way, you know there's no Orthodox car? I mean, Greek Orthodox, Coptic, because that's more of an ancient feel. Anyway, some of the most interesting stuff. But you could just say, I mean, you could even just say, where are the hospitals? Go to Chicago. Go to Lutheran General. Go to Rush Presbyterian. Go whatever. Where's the, like, the Voltaire Hospital? You know? Where's the Rousseau Boys Camp, you know, for disadvantaged urban children? Look, we're the guys who do the hospitals, you know, raise the economies, and so you could have that. All right, this is quick and dirty. You could use endorsers and just say, you don't believe in the Bible? Well, you know, people who teach like at Oxford and Princeton and so forth do, and they're smart. You know, C.S. Lewis could read a book. George Mavrodi's professor at University of Michigan, Robbie George, Princeton. I mean, you could just sort of say, look, I'm not so smart, but you don't have to be an idiot to believe the Bible. And you, I mean, that's just a little thing. You could also do reduction to absurdity. Philosophers use that all the time. You take a person's position and you press it. You say, oh, okay, let's ride around in your car a little while. You know, I believe that values are relative. There's not really a right or wrong, you know. I'm not, it's just kind of different strokes for different folks. And it's like, oh, good. Well, my value is to, like, kill you with a chainsaw. Oh, that would be wrong. Whoop, excuse me, you're not a relativist, are you? They were even saying in 911, even New Yorkers finally realized there was evil. You know, like, they thought, maybe it's not all relative. But, or you could just do, the Baha'i Temple is near us up in Wilmette, Illinois, and they have many ways to God, you know, that sort of thing. And they, like, the Zoroastrians and the Confucians and the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims and stuff. And you think, well, what about the principle of non-contradiction? Muslims say Jesus is not the Son of God. Christians do. Can they both be right? That doesn't seem right. Oh, well, they both are. Oh, then you don't believe in the principle of non-contradiction, which is the most fundamental rule of logic. So sometimes you can just say, we'll just check your thing out. Let's put the Bible aside. Let's look at what you got, Jack. And I mean, I'm in apologetics, so forgive me. I mean, my spirit's more combative there. Number nine, one thing you can do is just take a little piece of the Bible and just do some reasoning from it and just show the splendor of it. Genesis 1, 28, 27, 28, 26, right around, you know. Just unpack that. So it says, you know, in the image of God created he them. Image of God. wow, you know, why are you not keen on abortion? Why are you not keen on involuntary euthanasia or even cloning or something like that? And you say, well, look, we're not just the product of some primordial soup or something. We are actually made in the image of God. And it doesn't say what the image of God is. It doesn't say, well, it's rationality or the ability to communicate. Oh, okay, so here's a kid who is hydrocephalic. He's profoundly retarded. He has a low IQ, very, very low IQ. Therefore, we can euthanize him. Excuse me, his value is not based upon his performance. He is humanity, and humanity is made in the image of God. Now, of course, I say, well, that's interesting, but I don't buy the Bible. But what you're doing is you're demonstrating the beauty of the Bible when you come to an issue. And then I remember I was at Vanderbilt in the 60s or early 70s in a doctoral program, and we were teaching assistants in a course. And you got to know the early 70s were kind of like the late 60s, and there was one guy who walked around campus with cutoff jeans, and that was it. You know, no shirt, barefoot. And that went a lot better back in the 60s because people were kind of like doing dope and having free sex and having deep metaphysical insights, which were insane, but you could still cut a record and be famous. And he stood up one day and in class and said to the prof, Dr. Locks, do you realize that mankind has trespassed over 90% of the earth? And we're like, whoa, that's pretty heavy. You know, or like from Wayne's World, like, okay, you know, what is that about? But you think, no, actually, he created man to have dominion over, to be a steward of the world. And you go right back there, and someone might say, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. We're not invaders. We're actually the crown of creation. And it really is fun to kind of mess with people when they say, oh, see, the Bible's stupid. It says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and da-da-da-da-da. Like that. Well, the earth is just crawling with people, and there's no space. See, the Bible's stupid. Or we've done that. That's a wrap. And there's that Christian having like six kids. That's disgusting, you know, like rabbits. And then you say, okay, how many people are on earth? Well, I think it's 6.6 billion. All right. Let me ask you where you could put 6.6 billion people just standing closely together. What would they fit in? Just pick something in the United States and say, if you had all 6.6 billion and people stood relatively close together, where would they fit? Texas, maybe? Do you realize that if you gave each of them a 10-square-yard hut, they would still, and put them in Texas, you would still have enough room to put Oklahoma in the state. All right, the answer is Houston. You can fit 6.5 billion people in Houston standing close together. If you give them a square yard, like flat floor seating, you can fit them in Delaware. Like, oh, we've got 300 million in America now. Oh, yeah. Now, do you realize that we can all fit on Nantucket Island? It's sort of like the Bible really has some wisdom. And actually, in Europe, they're contraceiving themselves into oblivion. The birth rate in Italy is 1.2 per couple. Well, do the math. They just keep having this, and the next thing you know, all your work is done by people you import from Muslim lands, and you wake up one day and you've got Eurabia. Nothing wrong with Arabs, nothing wrong with Turks, something big wrong with Islam. You got Islam, you don't have Europe. People act as though they're all the same, you know. I'm telling you, if Ahmed had landed on Plymouth Rock, you would not have America. You'd have Mogadishu or something. I mean, you know, or at best, Riyadh or Ankara. It makes such a big difference. But what you can do is take a passage and tease it out. You could even take Genesis 3, the fall. We're not getting better and better. Seems like we're making the same mistakes they made back in the whatever day. Maybe the Bible knows what it's talking about. Read the first marriage, Genesis 2. Just like, you shall become one flesh. Man, think about that. We become kinfolk. And you just tease that out. So I'm just telling you, just take moral passages in the Bible, work with them, and I think they can say, wow, that has splendor, you know? All right. By the way, you could just do something about, let them be aware of the air they breathe. culturally, how much they owe to the Bible. You could do this a little bit more, but you could just say, if you call somebody a Judas, you know, or a scapegoat, or, I mean, so many of the words we use are biblical words. I was reading the journals of Lewis and Clark, you know, the expedition, and they got involved in some pretty hinky stuff. I mean, they were having theft and adultery and maybe a little murder here and there with the Indians, but they got out to the coast, and they were pretty hungry, and they found a beached whale on the coast in Oregon, I think it was, or southern Washington. And anyway, they ate some of it, and they basically said, today, unlike Jonah, you know, we ate the whale. And it was just a passing thing. It's not like we're going to get deeply spiritual here, but there was just such a saturation of the understanding of God that, you know. That, and by the way, I saw USA Today had this big thing at Christmas time a couple of years back, and it was like all the charities they're supporting. It's like Habitat for Humanity and the Susan Common breast or, you know, uterine cancer or whatever. And then you had the Boys Club and you had Ducks Unlimited and stuff. And I did an analysis of those 25, and I think I found like that 15 of them were founded by Christians with serious Christian understanding, including Special Olympics with whoever it was, Ethel Kennedy or one of the Kennedys. But Habitat for Humanity, which is very popular, that was founded by a guy who was tutored by a graduate of Southern Seminary. There's a fellow here named Clarence Jordan, pronounced Jordan, and in my dad's graduating class, of all things, my dad went here. And in the midst of the racist South setup, he went and founded a farm where blacks and whites worked together called Koinonia Farms. And he ended up writing the Cotton Patch version of the gospel. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's really funny. Like Jerusalem is Atlanta and Peter is called Rock and, you know, stuff like that. And I forget, was it Millard Fuller or something who came and studied it at Koinonia Farms and ended up founding Habitat for Humanity. So all these people on, and you just want to say, if you pull the Christianity out of the very air you breathe, then you wouldn't be involved in a lot of the stuff you do. I mean, every time you have like a frozen dinner, you know, like frozen peas or pizza or something like that, that came from a mission trip. Actually, I think was it Grenville who was up in Hudson Bay, and he had a guy with him named Clarence Birdseye, and they were up working with the Eskimos, and they'd pull some old fish out of the water, and by the time they had it in a box, it was frozen hard, and they noticed that it preserved, and Birdseye said, hey, I think that'll work, and next thing you know, you got it in your freezer, and thank God for missions. You know, it's just everywhere. So anyway, I could list another 10, but we're out of time, but I'm just telling you, there are so many resources to answer criticisms of the Bible. Hard to substitute for just getting them to actually read the Bible. If they don't accept the Bible, you say, okay, fine, we'll look at the way the world works. God created the world, we can read that. Or let's just celebrate what the Bible does. I mean, it's the book. It is the book. And you never have to be ashamed of that. It's really the power of God. I think one thing in church, we're sort of nervous about the Bible. Like, people won't think that's cool. So, you know, if I could, like, grow a soul patch or put on a Hawaiian shirt or, you know, set my hair on fire, then I can draw a crowd and maybe they'll think I'm cool and stuff. Look, I pastor people. I'm the only guy wearing a tie in church. And, you know, I'm overweight and bald and old. And you know, but the only thing I got going for me with these Northwestern students is that I preach the Bible, you know. I mean, I'm just a donkey, but I'm carrying a treasure. And the power is in the Word. So if you want to mess with them, just say, you know, hey, I don't know, what do you think? Read that. Incidentally, Jerry Vines tells a story of a guy who was a strong soul winner, and he was illiterate. And I said, how did he do it? Well, he had this tract, and he would take it to somebody and ask him to read it. He said, I can't read. And then after they read it, he said, well, what do you think? You know, and they say, well, it makes sense to me. You say, well, do you want to accept Christ? And he's winning people to the Lord. The power is in the gospel and in the Word. So, and the fact that they don't buy it is no reflection on you. Don't be wounded by that. And I want to tell you, if you've ever seen the movie, there's several movies like this. One was like My Bodyguard. Actually, that's kind of an older movie. But, you know, you're kind of like a kid and the bullies are threatening you. But you really can say, excuse me, I need you to talk to my brother here. And you bring in C.S. Lewis or someone like that, and he'll mess them up, you know. So there's some really heavy hitters. Call Dr. Moore. They'll come to your house, you know, and defend you. They'll menace the bullies. Anyway, and of course, pray for them. Just pray for them. But a lot of times, they just don't know the Bible. I mean, people in churches don't know the Bible. I was taking a stand about divorce and remarriage, huge issue in the church, and when not, and all that. And I had a guy who was remarried and very tender fellow. He wanted to know what God was. He said, now, what was that about? I mean, what is that about the Bible? And I turned to Mark 10:10, 10:11, and he read it and like, oh, wow, you know, I never saw this. Even people in churches don't know what's in the Bible a lot of times. So give it a chance, you know. Any quick questions or? I just said show them the way our culture is saturated with biblical. It's kind of like the presupposition or the groundwork for a lot of our institutions and language, you know. I mean, even Northwestern University, it's really fun when you're on campus, just point up to the seal carved in stone and say, yeah, I mean, they actually have one Bible verse around it that says something like, whatsoever things are true, you know, that sort of passage, and that's in Latin. And then the inside is in Greek, you know, what is it? The word halagos, pleres, full of grace, caritas and aletheia or something, kai aletheia. One thing we love to do at Evanston, our street names are like Methodist holy men. They don't even know it. I was driving through Evanston the first time, and there's Asbury Street and Wesley and like that. So we made a little brochure with 13 street names with the words, the gospel words of the people. Dempster, Reverend John Dempster, whew, Hartman, Hinman, Willard, you know, Judson, Wesley, Asbury, First Methodist Bishop in America, Hartzell, First Methodist Bishop in Africa. And we're saying, these guys are talking about the gospel. The most sophisticated hotel in town is the Omni Orrington. And that's where, like, when Michigan comes to play, you know, the big bus pulls up and all the players get off. Here's the testimony of Orrington Lunt, how he came to the Lord. And he talks about being converted, and he heard this song. And you're just saying, you wouldn't have Evanston. You wouldn't have Northwestern University if Jesus Christ didn't get a hold of some people. So, like, get off your high horse or something. All right. Thanks for your kind listening. And great to be with you guys.